gathered together from the far reaches of the internet are assembled a network of podcasts dedicated to the first and greatest superhero, Superman. The Superman Podcast Network is dedicated to covering all aspects of the Superman legend, featuring
The Thrilling Adventures of Superman,
Golden Age Superman,
The Superman Fan Podcast,
Superman in the Bronze Age,
From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman Podcast,
Superman Forever Radio,
The Superman Vidcast,
The World's Best Podcast,
and
Radio Kale from SupermanHomepage.com,
as well as the audio dramas Superman, Last Son of Krypton, and Supergirl, Last Daughter of Krypton, from Pendant Audio Production. Join hosts
Michael Bradley,
John Wilson,
Billy Hogan,
Charlie Niemeyer,
Jeffrey Taylor,
Michael Bailey,
J. David Weeder, Cayman
Stoll, I'm Isaac,
I'm Adam,
Dave Eunice, and co-host Scotty V.
at SupermanPodcastNetwork.com.
This is the Superman Fan Podcast. I'm your host, Billy Hogan. Put on your indestructible cape and join me as together we'll crash through the time barrier and fly into the past to explore the Silver Age adventures of Superman. This is episode number 208, the Superman comic book, cover dated March 1960. Action Comics number 262 for the week of Wednesday, December 7th, 2011. And I'm recording this on Thursday morning of the 8th, the day after Pearl Harbor Day. So our thoughts go to all of those who lost their lives during the Pearl Harbor attack by the Imperial Japanese Navy. Yesterday I happened to read an article about one Pearl Harbor survivor who, after he passed away recently, had some of his ashes returned to the ship that he served on, the Utah. Now, I would have recorded this episode yesterday, except I had a little bit of extra unexpected things to take care of. My daughter's car wouldn't start Tuesday evening when she was going to come home from college over from UCF. Luckily, she was able to get it jump-started. So yesterday morning, I took it to the auto parts store where we'd gotten the battery. And it did have a dead cell, so I exchanged the battery. Well, later in the day, my daughter went to do some Christmas shopping, and her car wouldn't start again. So I was wondering, is it the battery still? At this point I was ready just to take it to my regular mechanic and get a battery that he recommends. But anyway, I tried to jump start it, and it wouldn't start, so I figured it might be the starter. So luckily we have road service on my daughter's car, so we had it towed to our mechanic, and unfortunately it was the starter and not a cheap one either, so that ate into the time I had to kind of prep for this episode, so that's why I'm a day late. And we got it back this morning, so everything's back to normal now. And that's all the personal anecdotes I have, except that this Saturday, my family and I are going to my sister-in-law's for my wife's family Christmas get-together. On my side of the family, we usually get together on Christmas Eve for gift exchange and dinner. And so that's all the personal news. We are in the middle of getting our Christmas tree decorated. My daughter and her boyfriend came over last night and he got it started, so we'll finish up today. And so after a few promos for some Superman podcasts. We begin our look at Action Comics number 262.
Look, up in the sky.
It's a bird.
It's a plane. No, it's SupermanHomepage.com, the number one Superman fan site in the world. SupermanHomepage.com, covering the world of Superman from the 1930s to today. News, reviews, rumors, and reports. SupermanHomepage.com for all your Superman comics, TV shows, movies, cartoons, radio shows, and more. Everything you ever wanted to know about the Man of Steel and more. SupermanHomepage.com.
Action Comics number 262, the March 1960 issue, was published on January 28, 1960. It contained 32 pages for the cover price of 10 cents. The editor was Mort Weisinger, and the cover was penciled by Kurt Swan and inked by Stan Kay. And if memory serves, it featured Supergirl in her third cover appearance on Action Comics. It showed her lifting a tree over her head, while in the foreground, Superman was overcome by kryptonite radiation, which she seemed to be immune to. And since this is, we're just looking at one issue, we will be looking at the other features in this comic book, including the Metropolis mailbag. On the inside front cover, there was an ad for a He-Man building picture courses by the Jowett Institute of New York, New York. The course was free, but you did require 10 cents postage and handling. The Superman story for the issue was titled When Superman Lost His Powers, and this 13-page story was written by Robert Bernstein, penciled by Wayne Boring, and inked by Stan Kay, and was reprinted in Showcase Presents Superman Volume 2. It began with Clark, Lois, and Jimmy in the Mexican jungle to cover the opening of an Aztec tomb for the first time, when they were joined by Perry White, who had been vacationing in Mexico City, and when he heard about them covering the opening of this Aztec tomb, decided to fly over via helicopter and join them as a way to feel like a young reporter again in one of Perry's rare appearances outside the office, and not only that, without his coat and tie. They explored the tomb, and Clark read an ancient Aztec inscription, which read, "Whoever enters the king's tomb is doomed to spend 2 days in a world so dangerous that no one has ever returned from it." To which Lois responded, "Bunk. If you're afraid, Clark, I'll hold your hand." Ever a sympathetic person, Lois. So she says, "Come on, guys, let's see what's inside." Well, when they entered, they smelled a strange odor, and the door closed behind them, and they all became dizzy and passed out, including Clark Kent. When they woke up, they were in a strange world of giant insects, and Clark was stung by a giant bee. And in one of the rare instances where Clark is panicked, he discovers that he is no longer invulnerable and has lost his superpowers because the bee sting penetrated his skin, including his previously invulnerable Superman costume. Then a nearby giant spider sprang into action and began spinning a web, and somehow Clark figured out that the spider was attracted by Lois's purple jacket. And his theory was proved true, apparently, when she reversed her jacket, put it on, and the spider calmed down. And Clark assumed they must be in a different dimension. And they were driven into hiding in a cave when a fire-breathing dragon swooped down from the sky. Well, after that, Jimmy alerted Superman with his signal watch, and Clark thought to himself that this was his most difficult job of his career, since he had to somehow keep the secret that he had lost his superpowers, as Superman, that is, from Lois Clark and Lois, Perry, and Jimmy, while keeping them safe. To protect his secret identity, Clark feigned coming down with a fever from the insect sting, encouraged him to leave him behind so he could rest. Well, first they agreed until Lois accused Clark of faking it just so he could change into Superman. And so Clark challenged her. Okay, smarty, get out your medical kit. He showed her the swelling on his arm. Of course, he had rolled up the sleeve to a Superman uniform where she couldn't notice it. And she was able to penetrate his skin with a needle and give him a shot of penicillin. Well, when Superman didn't show up, Jimmy assumed that the Man of Steel must be on a space mission. And the penicillin kind of made him groggy, so Clark took a nap for about an hour while the others explored. Since he had no superpowers, he couldn't compress his Clark Kent clothes and put them in the secret pouch on the inside of his cape, so he hid them under a rock. And then once he's changed into his Superman uniform, he set up a grand entrance while the others were away by poking hole in a giant egg, which was nested on a cliff. And underneath that cliff, there was like a hollow area. So he punched some holes into the egg to allow the sun to dry it out. And he created a hole in the rock ledge underneath so that the sand could trickle down. And finally, when the egg was dehydrated, Superman made his presence known. He stood below the egg, which the others thought was a boulder. And when it fell on Superman, it smashed into dust simulate his invulnerability. While the others weren't looking, he tucked some of the egg dust into his cape pocket. And to hide the fact that he didn't have any more superpowers, when he said, "Great, Superman, you can take us back." Now, he encouraged him to explore the area some more as a feature article after their return. He had to figure out a way to protect his friends from the fire-breathing dragon. Well, Lois, Perry, and Jimmy saw the Man of Steel swoop after the fire-breathing dragon, and Superman threw some egg dust in the eyes of the dragon. What the others didn't know that he had turned himself into a kite by building a wooden frame and attaching it to his cape. And when he glided to the earth, he was lucky enough to make a crash landing onto soft grass to avoid any injury. The next day, using some binoculars he had borrowed from the camp, he kept an eye on his other friends from the Daily Planet, and he was able to read Lois's lips and figure out that she was headed back to the cave to check on Clark. While Perry and Jimmy fished, Superman put his shirt and cape in the water to, since his clothes were no longer invulnerable, that some of the color leaked from the red in of his cape and the blue of his shirt leaked out to create the water purple and agitate the giant spiders to begin spinning their webs, allowing Superman to cross the chasm and beat Lois back to the cave, where she found Clark shaving with a sharp rock. And to test her theory that Clark was secretly Superman, she even cut a lock of his hair and was surprised and maybe even a little disappointed when she was able to cut a little bit of his hair. Superman returned later to Perry and Jimmy's fishing spot just in time to see a sea serpent grab Jimmy's camera case. Well, the Man of Steel dove in to retrieve it, noticing that the serpent's mouth was too small to bite, but it wasn't too small to grab the strap to the case. How he was able to figure out was beyond me, because the mouth seemed to be big enough to bite somebody, to me at least. The giant eel wrapped itself around Superman, who had taken some hollow reeds so that he could breathe underwater until the eel calmed down and swam away. And when Superman surfaced with the camera case, he covered himself by claiming that he had explored underwater. Back at the camp, he took the fish that Perry and Jimmy had caught, and they had said, well, why build a fire when Superman can just use his X-ray vision to cook them? So he took them and built a fire elsewhere, but he didn't light it. He attracted the fire-breathing dragon by throwing some of the egg dust into the air and provoking it to breathe its fire breath on the fish, cooking them. And while Perry, Jimmy, and Lois ate their fish, Superman snuck off and changed back into Clark Kent, and when he returned, explained that Superman had to attend to an emergency, plus the 48 hours were about up, and they would soon be returned mysteriously back to the Aztec tomb. And when they awaken back at the inside the Aztec tomb, a Mexican helper, I assume, noted that they had been asleep for only 2 minutes, not 2 days, when they mentioned about their adventure. However, Jimmy noticed that his film had been ruined by water. And the next day, back in Metropolis, Superman discovered his powers had returned, but I don't understand why he wouldn't have recognized that as soon as they returned back to the Aztec tomb, but I guess it makes a more dramatic scene showing Superman flying up to a thundercloud and being struck by lightning, and he also saved a car from being run over by a train. And back at the Daily Planet, while Clark had his back turned to Lois, she was now unable to cut his hair from when that she had saved from when they were at that other strange world, but she was still confused that about Superman's secret identity, while Clark winked at the reader, and that's where the story ended. And Perry made one of his few rare appearances outside of the office. Not only that, as I mentioned earlier, didn't even have a coat and tie on. Of course, why would he if he was on vacation? I did have a question. I'd like to learn where Clark was able to learn how to read ancient Aztec inscriptions. And don't you love the ever-sympathetic and supportive Lois, when who always leaps where angels fear to dread, when she told Clark, what do you want? Clark, want me to hold your hand? Let's go, boys. Let's explore this place. On page 3, when Clark discovered after being stung by the giant bee that he was powerless, it was the most panicked expression I've ever seen from Clark. And the story never made clear if they had been transported to another dimension, another world, a hidden jungle somewhere else on Earth. Did they travel through time? However, it didn't really hurt the story. It probably helped not explaining where exactly they were. Because sometimes when you learn a mystery, it kind of spoils the allure of the adventure. On page 6, when Superman dehydrated the egg, I had to wonder if everyone else, if they were nearby, wouldn't they smell the rotting egg? And I couldn't help but wonder if in the panel, when we saw smoke rising from the hole Superman punched into the eggshell, if it wasn't the reek of rotting egg that was also rising up out of the egg. One thing I liked about the story was that it showed a rare aspect about Superman that is not his powers that make him Superman. It's the fact that he's willing to take whatever risk in order to help others. He certainly risked serious injury, if not death, by turning himself into a human kite on pages 8 and 9 when he simulated his flight power. He certainly was able to find clever ways to fake his powers and avoid the suspicion that he was powerless And secondly, that he was really Clark Kent. The various scenes showed him imitating his invulnerability, the flight, his telescopic vision when he used the binoculars, and of course super speed when he ran across a giant web and used a hollow reed to help him breathe underwater when he fought the eel. The story did have a couple mysteries, you know, with the adventure must have been real, but if it only took place in 2 minutes, you know, why was Jimmy's film wet, and then the lock of hair that from Clark that Lois had cut, why was it now invulnerable? So it never made clear how 2 days of an adventure could happen in 2 minutes. But overall, it was a fun story, so I can't help but give it 4 Superman capes out of 5. And after more promos for other Superman podcasts, we'll take a look at more of the features in Action Comics number 262, including the Metropolis Mailbag.
In 1992, the greatest hero the world has ever known died defending his city from a force of nature. That force of nature had a name.
Doomsday.
From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast is a weekly internet radio program presented by the Superman homepage in association with the Superman Podcast Network. Every week, hosts Michael Bailey and Jeffrey Taylor examine the comic book adventures of Superman from Man of Steel number 1 in 1986 to Adventures of Superman number 649 in 2006. Now they begin their coverage of the epic Death and Return of Superman trilogy with the first chapter of that story,
Doomsday.
From the first round to the ultimate sacrifice, Mike and Jeff will go through Doomsday in detail with the occasional special guest and a few surprises as well. Doomsday comes to From Crisis to Crisis beginning December 2011 at both www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com and www.supermanhomepage.com.
Hey everybody, my name is Michael Bailey, and this is the trailer with a truly epic ending to my new show about Batman, appropriately titled Bailey's Batman Podcast. Bailey's Batman Podcast is a weekly program that looks at a month in the life of the Dark Knight Detective, starting with the books bearing a March 1983 cover date, which is where my solid run of the character's comics begins, and moving forward until, well, at least until the books that came out in 2005, because that's where the solid run ends. Each week, I will give you a full synopsis and review of every major ongoing Batman title, with brief stops along the way to look at the important specials, miniseries, one-shots, and Elseworld stories, just to keep things interesting. I'll also be telling you what other books Batman appeared in that month, as well as what was going on elsewhere in the DCU. It is going to be all Batman, all the time, as I look at over 20 years of the character's history. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the epic ending to this trailer. You ready? The first appearance of Jason Todd. Death in the Family. Nightfall. Epic. No Man's Land. Do you have chills yet? All of that and more will be covered on Bailey's Batman Podcast every Tuesday at baileysbatmanpodcast.com.
After this story, there was a full-page public service announcement ad, which was first used in two episodes ago in the Superman comic books cover dated February 1960, Buzzy's Famous Books Quiz, written by Jack Schiff, with art by Ruben Moreira, or Moira, however you spell that name, pardon me for mispronouncing it, and lettered by Ira Schnapp. And I won't go over the trivia questions, but I will repeat that they involve the books Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson, The Black Stallion, written by Walter Farley, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, written by Mark Twain, and Little Women, written by Louisa May Alcott. And on the next page was a half-page humor strip, Peg, written and drawn by Henry Boltonoff. And it was the strip was about when Peg bought an expensive bottle of perfume to impress her boyfriend. Unfortunately, that day, he had a cold, and so he wasn't able to smell a thing that day. On the bottom half of the ad was an ad for where he could earn cash and prizes by selling Cloverine salve and also get free foreign coins. And you could mail the coupon to the Wilson Chemical Company of Tyrone, Pennsylvania. And on the next page was a humor strip, which took up two-thirds of the page, for Shorty, written and drawn by Henry Boltonoff. And in this strip, Shorty had trouble keeping dressed for the weather because as soon as he, for instance, it would rain, then he would put his raincoat on. He'd come out, it was all dry and warm, and the weather kept changing on him, so he was never able to get coordinated with his wardrobe and be dressed for the weather, the crazy weather that day. And on the bottom third of that page was a statement of ownership for National Comics Publications Incorporated, then at the address of 575 Lexington Avenue, with the postal code of New York, 22 New York. And this was in the days just before zip codes were first used by the U.S. Postal Service. And after that was the full-page Metropolis mailbag. And for this issue, it began with the first letter, Dear Editor, how did Luthor get his name and what is his origin? And the editor responded, Luthor's full name is Lex Luthor. Oddly enough, his initials are LL, like those of Lois Lane, Lana Lang, Linda Lee, and Lori Lamaris. As a teenager, young Luthor was once a good friend of Superboy's. For the complete story of his origin, see the April issue of Adventure Comics. And you can eventually listen to J. David Weider go over this story in his podcast, The Smallville Chronicles, a Superboy podcast. The next letter read, Dear Editor, I enjoy all your Supergirl stories, but I often wonder why isn't Linda, Supergirl Lee, missed at the orphanage when she is out on an adventure? And the editor responded, Supergirl often uses a Linda Lee robot to pinch hit for her when she is away on a mission. See the last page of the Supergirl story in this issue. And we will take a closer look at that a little bit later in this episode. The third letter read, Dear Editor, I am just recovering from rheumatic fever. During my convalescence, I read one of your magazines. I've been reading them ever since. Your magazine is so super that I hardly miss an issue of the Superman Comics family. A true fan, Janine Russo of Liberty, New York. And I failed to mention who wrote the first two letters. First one, about Lex Luthor's origin, was written by Stephen Pascal of Flushing, New York. And the letter about Supergirl was written by Jay Cantel of Baltimore, Maryland. And the next letter also was about Supergirl, and it read, Dear Editor, could you please tell me when Supergirl will let the world know that she exists? Written by Tom Kent of Costa Mesa, California. And the editor responded, "As has been explained in several stories, Supergirl must remain unknown to the world so that she can serve as Superman's secret weapon if an emergency ever takes place. But don't give up. Several surprises are in store for Supergirl fans." And the next letter read, "Dear Editor, whatever happened to the Bizarro Superman and the Bizarro Lois Lane who left Earth together after their last adventure with Superman? My friends and I would love to see a sequel featuring the return of these pathetic non-human creatures who are grotesque imitations of Superman and Lois Lane. Signed, Bill Hall, Drayton Plains, Michigan." And the editor wrote, "Tip off your friends to get the next issue of Action Comics. It features one of the most sensational stories we've ever published, The World of Bizarros." The next letter read, "Dear Editor, is it true that you plan to publish a giant Superman annual issue, which will sell for 25 cents and feature many of the best stories you've printed in the past? If so, will it feature stories about Crypto, Jimmy Olsen, Super Baby, Jor-El, Mr. Mixius Pidalic, etc.? Signed, Gordon Gates, Chicago, Illinois." The editor wrote, "Yes, such a project is in the works. Readers can help us by sending us a postcard listing the stories they would like to see reprinted. Mail all postcards to Superman Annual Issue, 575 Lexington Avenue, New York, 22, New York. Be sure to supply your name and address so that we can notify you when this giant annual would be on sale." And I believe this annual will be published later in 1960. And when it does, we will devote a whole episode just on the annual, because it will be an 80-page giant. And it would make too long of an episode to include that in the regular Superman issues that we cover. And I'm really looking forward to when we get to that first Superman annual. The next letter read, "Dear Editor, just a line to let you know how much I enjoy the adventures of Congo Bill ever since you gave him the magic ring which enables him to switch bodies with the golden ape Congorilla. Signed, Ruth Pell of Passaic, New Jersey." Spelled P-A-S-S-A-I-C, New Jersey. And pardon me if you live there and I mispronounced your city's name. And the editor wrote, "Thanks for the kind words. Don't fret, though, because there is no Congorilla story in this issue. Inasmuch as we have expanded Supergirl into a full-length feature, we have given Congorilla a new home in our companion magazine, Adventure Comics. You'll find the golden ape up to his usual jungle tricks in the March issue of Adventure." And so we say goodbye to Congo Bill and Congorilla in Action Comics. Although when we do the Elsewhere in DC Comics, I'll keep tabs on how many adventures he's been in. The next letter read, "Dear Editor, in a recent issue, a boy suggested Clark Kent adopt Supergirl. You replied, but who would be Supergirl's foster mother? Kelly on the TV show Bachelor Father doesn't have a mother. Her uncle works, and Kelly is in school almost all day. If Kelly can do this, why can't Linda Supergirl Lee do it too? Signed, Barbara Jean Bertratus of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania." That's a good question, Barbara. And the editor responded, it's quite okay for an uncle to adopt his niece as in Bachelor Father, and the courts would permit Clark Kent to adopt Linda if he could establish that she was his cousin. But in order to prove that Linda was related to him, it would mean giving away the fact that they are secretly Superman and Supergirl. So this solution is not practical. I don't know about that. I think it was it makes sense as far as, Superman and Supergirl, but, Clark Kent could mention, he would probably have to forge a birth certificate and say she was a relative of the Kents, create a false identity, in other words, for Linda. Kara Zor-El, and back in the 1960s, it's probably a lot easier than what it would be today. So I think it was just a way for the editor to find a convenient way to kind of dodge the issue, so to speak. Because really, Clark could have adopted Linda without revealing that, you know, he without endangering his secret identity by saying she was like Linda Kent or something like that, or Linda Clark, say she was from his mother's side of the family. But of course, if she lived in Metropolis and a Supergirl started appearing, you know, that would make Clark's life a little more complicated. So maybe the editor isn't that far off the mark after all. The next letter read, "Dear Editor, I found quite a few goofs in the Cave Girl of Steel. You showed Dimetrodon coexisting with a Ceratosaurus and a Brontosaurus. The Dimetrodon lived 190 million years ago, and the other beasts lived 125 years ago. Also, pterosaurs couldn't pick themselves up and fly. They glided along off high spots like cliffs. And you stated that the Brontosaurus was the longest dinosaur. Actually, the longest was the Plotticus, which was 37 feet long. Your writers have good imaginations, but they're rotten historians. Signed, Robert Fried, Whitestone, New York." I'd be interested in knowing how this old Robert is. Is he a paleontologist? Or is he just a dinosaur nerd as a kid? And the final letter read, "Dear Editor, I am sick of readers who always find little boo-boos and flaws. Readers should be praising you instead of heckling you. The fine stories you give us for a dime are wonderful. Keep up the good work. Signed, Dennis Fowler, Sioux City, Iowa." Well, I guess this was the editor's way of answering Robert's letter, you think? And that finishes up the Metropolis mailbag. After more Superman podcast promos, we'll take a look at the Supergirl story, which, as was mentioned in the Metropolis mailbag, has been expanded.
Rocketed as a baby from the exploding planet Krypton, Kal-El grew to manhood on Earth, whose yellow sun and lighter gravity gave him fantastic superpowers. In the city of Metropolis, he poses as TV newsman Clark Kent, but battles evil all over Earth and beyond as Superman. Superman in the Bronze Age is a weekly podcast following the adventures of Superman from 1970 to the Byrne reboot in 1986. Follow along at supermaninthebronzeage.blogspot.com.
Take the mightiest superheroes on Earth, each an invincible champion of justice. Band them together in a common cause against crime and evil, and you have the Justice League of America.
And now their adventures are being chronicled on the Podcast of Justice, a bi-weekly podcast covering every issue of the Justice League from the Silver Age to today. Join hosts
Charlie Niemeyer
and Isaac Frisbee podcastofjustice.blogspot.com.
The Supergirl story for this issue was titled Supergirl's Greatest Victory. It was 12 pages long instead of the usual 8, as the Metropolis mailbag explained. It was expanded, so now Action Comics will only have 2 stories for a while. And it was written by Otto Bender and drawn by Jim Mooney. And this story has been reprinted in the Supergirl Archives Volume 1 and the Showcase Presents Supergirl Volume 1. And it began during recess when Linda Lee helped some kids who were wanting to fly kites, but there was no wind, so she used her super breath to keep the kites floating in the air. Later, when she noticed that there was a crack in a sidewalk in front of where some girls were roller skating, she used her X-ray vision to seal the crack. And later, she overheard the headmaster tell his aide that it almost seemed that there was a good fairy watching over the orphanage because there really didn't seem to be any accidents or anybody getting hurt. Her super hearing later picked up the sound, distant sound, and using her telescopic vision, saw a kryptonite meteor falling near some where some forest rangers were driving through the national park and looking out for any fires. She heard them say that they would warn Superman after their fire patrol, and later, checking on the Fortress of Solitude using her telescopic vision, she saw Superman flying to his fortress. That evening, she wrote in her diary, and we get a flashback kind of reprising her origin story. Well, then Linda had a great idea and flew to the fortress and suggested to Superman that they develop a vaccine against kryptonite radiation. Well, Superman informed her that he had tried and it didn't work, but Supergirl posed a question. Maybe it would have worked if he had been younger, maybe like on her. But the Man of Steel told her to forget it and showed her some of his new trophies. He had a light, tight box, and he told her to use her X-ray vision, and she saw a flower which Superman had found in a dark world. And the reason he kept it in a light, tight box was that if it was exposed to light, it would wither. Well, in the panel where she used her X-ray vision, we see that her X-ray vision penetrated the box and went through the box and cracked the glass cage behind it. In another small clear box, Superman had found some mini dinosaurs from a world where the insects were giants and the dinosaurs were small. Sound like a plot for a 1960s science fiction horror film. Superman fed some iron nails to his pet metal eaters. Well, he noticed that instead of two, there was one missing. Supergirl noticed a hole in the glass cage behind the dark box of containing the dark flower, and she figured that her X-ray vision must have cracked the glass cage holding the metal eater. After making quick repairs, and after finding the other metal eater, Supergirl returned to the orphanage, and later, during recess week, Supergirl found where the kryptonite meteor had fallen, and she lifted part of the ground and created a ramp so that the meteor rolled into a cave. And each day, she would mark the spot where she, how far she could, how close she could get to the kryptonite meteor before getting weak. And she found that day by day, she was able to get a little bit closer before becoming weak. And Superman, checking up on his super cousin with his telescopic vision, noticed this as well. Then as he fed the metal eaters, Superman noticed one of them was kind of sad. So he fed that one a piece of gold, one of its favorites, and as a way to try to cheer it up. Later, Superman was boring underground, searching for fossils for scientists when he discovered another tunnel that he didn't remember creating, but he also found some buried kryptonite and was quickly overcome by the harmful radiation. Meanwhile, Supergirl was now able to touch the kryptonite meteor with only some minor discomfort and also keeping all of her superpowers, so she used her telescopic vision to search for Superman so she could fly to him and inform him of the good news, when she found the Man of Steel overcome by kryptonite radiation. Well, she burrowed underground to the rescue, saying, "I laugh at kryptonite radiation. It can't hurt me anymore." Well, much to her surprise, she was quickly overcome. And Superman thought he knew the reason why, but it would be pointless if they both perished. The Man of Steel asked Supergirl to aim her X-ray vision at a vein of gold above the kryptonite, and they both used their X-ray vision to melt the gold, which covered the kryptonite rock, but the kryptonite radiation converted the gold to lead and allowed them to escape. And when they investigate Supergirl's cave, they discovered that the kryptonite meteorite that she had discovered was now being eaten by another, a third metal eater. And Superman explained that he had followed the veins of the meteor ores to Supergirl's cave, and that the other metal eater must have been drawn to the kryptonite and had begun eating the kryptonite rock from the other side where she couldn't see, and was hollowing it out from the inside. And that would explain why she felt the effects of kryptonite radiation less and less every day, as this metal eater continued to feast on the rock. As they carried the small metal eater back to the Fortress of Solitude, they returned it to what it, as it turned out to be, its mother. And that was why that other metal eater was sad in Superman's Fortress of Solitude. That evening, Linda Lee wrote in her diary that another attempt to gain immunity to kryptonite had laid an egg. And overall, I have to say this is another fun Silver Age Supergirl story. She showed a bit of innocent, youthful brashness, thinking that her younger age would give her an advantage in being able to gain some type of immunity to kryptonite. I guess she was figuring that a little bit of exposure every day would build up some resistance, kind of like an inoculation. It was a mystery how she was able to seem to gain immunity so quickly, but as we saw by the end of the story, that was revealed to be this baby metal eater. It was clever how it set up with the escape of the what turned out to be the female metal eater, and I liked how the plot laid out the clues until the mystery was solved. And we learned exactly why the metal eater was so sad. It was missing and worried about its baby. And I have to give this cute story 4 Superman capes out of 5. And after that, well, on the next page was a humor strip which took up 2/3 of the page. It was titled Jerry the Jitterbug, another Henry Boltonoff strip, where Jerry planned to have his friends say good things about him to impress his new girl, but that plan backfired. And the bottom third of the page was an ad which teased to other Superman family titles. In the April issue of Lois Lane, on sale February 9th, Lois Lane became the Kryptonite Girl. And on the March issue of Adventure Comics, on sale January 28th, The Stolen Identities was the title of the Supergirl story. And that issue also contained stories starring Aquaman and Aqualad and Kongorilla in his new home in Adventure Comics. With the April cover date, and on sale February 4th, the next issue of Superman, which would feature 3 Superman stories, the first one being the Super Clown of Metropolis, the Man Who Married Lois Lane, and the Secret of Kryptonite, which we will review in the next in 2 episodes from now. And after that was a full-page ad for a Treasure Chest of Fun, which was a bunch of mini ads, including the black eye joke and the black gum that would make your teeth, lips and gums and teeth turn black when you chew it. And you could mail your order in to the Honor House Products, which seemed kind of a misnomer, judging by some of the prizes that are not prizes, but things you can order. The price range went from 20 cents to $4.98 for a mini radio, which didn't require batteries. After that was a full-page ad where you could earn money selling patriotic and religious slogans. You can send your order in to the Stevens Credit Sales of Nashville, Tennessee. And on the inside back cover was a full-page ad for a stamp collection kit. We could send in 25 cents to the Zenith Company of Brooklyn, New York. And on the back cover was an ad I remember seeing as a kid where you could earn cash and prizes selling seeds from the American Seed Company of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And this wraps up Action Comics number 262. After some more promos for some Superman podcasts, we'll take a look at elsewhere in DC Comics carrying the March or March-April 1960 cover date.
Presenting Supergirl's Cosmic Adventures, a podcast dedicated to the continuing adventures of the Maid of Might herself, Supergirl. Episodes can be found at supergirlpodcast.blogspot.com.
In the city of Metropolis, Clark Kent appears to be a mild-mannered reporter for the Daily Planet. Unknown to the world, he's also Superman, fighting a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the American way. But before there was Metropolis, there was Smallville. Before there was Lois Lane, there was Lana Lane. Before he was Superman, he had adventures as Superboy. Dave's Amazing World of Superman presents the Smallville Chronicles, a Superboy podcast, a weekly look at the adventures of Superman when he was a boy, featuring an issue-by-issue look at the pages of Superboy from his appearances in Adventure Comics and his own title. Find it weekly at AmazingWorldOfSuperman.com.
Elsewhere in DC Comics, there were 27 titles which carried the March or March-April 1960 cover date, so it was kind of a light month for DC. The first three titles were published during the month of December 1959, all of them DC's romance titles, beginning on or around December 3rd, since in this era, most dates are approximate since records aren't complete for this era. And beginning December 3rd, 59, Girls Romances number 66, which featured the fourth and final story on the cover, Ring of Heartbreak. And a few days before Christmas, around December 22nd, 1959, Falling in Love number 33, which also featured the fourth and final story of the on the cover, Dream Sweetheart. And finally, close to New Year's Eve, published around December 29th, Girls Love Stories number 69, which featured the fourth and final story on the cover as well, Mistaken Identity. And the rest of DC's titles carrying the March or March-April 1960 cover date were published during the month of January 1960, beginning with around January 5th, Our Army at War number 92, edited by Robert Conninger, which featured the first of three stories on the cover, titled Luck of Easy, and it featured Sergeant Rock in his 11th appearance. Also that week, Superboy number 79, featuring the third and final story on the cover, Life on Krypton, which sounds like it will be interesting. And I look forward to listening to J. David Weider talk about this story on the Smallville Chronicles, a Superboy podcast. And finally that week, Superman's Pal Jimmy Olsen number 43, which featured the third and final story on the cover, Jimmy Olsen's Private Monster. And that sounds like it's going to be nothing but trouble for Superman. Published around January 7th, The House of Mystery, issue number 96, edited by Jack Schiff, which featured the third and final story on the cover, The Pirate Brain. Also that week, the March-April issue of Pat Boone, number 4. And this series would only last for one more issue. And joining Pat Boone on inside were Johnny Mathis, Bobby Darin, and actress Diane Baker. And finally that week, the March-April issue of Tomahawk number 67, which featured the third and final story on the cover, The Beast from the Deep. And it looked like this story, this issue, edited by Jack Schiff, had Tomahawk battling some prehistoric creature, which would begin to be a common occurrence in Tomahawk eventually. Published on January 12th, Black Hawk, number 146, also edited by Jack Schiff, which featured the third and final story on the cover, The Menace of the Scorpion. It almost sounds like a villain for Spider-Man, but that's not for a couple of years yet. Also that week, My Greatest Adventures, also edited by Jack Schiff, issue number 41, and the story, I Became the Beetle Beast. And finally that week, the March-April issue of TV Screen Cartoons, number 133, which was previously called Real Screen Comics. And this series would only last for 6 more issues before it's canceled. It contains stories starring The Fox and the Crow, Tito and His Burrito, one of the most non-PC characters I've ever heard of, and Flippity and Flop. Published on January 14th, 1960, Batman number 130, also edited by Jack Schiff, which features the third and final Bat story on the cover, The Hand from Nowhere. Also that week, House of Secrets number 30, also edited by Jack Schiff, which featured the third and final story on the cover, The Creature City, which starred Mark Merlin in his 8th appearance as a supernatural investigator. And finally that week, the March-April issue of Sergeant Bilko number 18 in his final DC issue before he retires, unless some other company picked up the title. And so Sergeant Bilko will retire, well, at least from comic books. I'm not sure how much longer that series would last. Published around the week of January 19th, the March-April issue of The Adventures of Jerry Lewis, number 57, which did not have a story title featured on the cover. Next was the March-April issue of Our Fighting Forces, number 54, edited by Robert Coniger, featuring the first of 3 stories on the cover, and Egg for Sarge, featuring the 12th appearance of Gunner and Sarge. Also that week, the Tales of the Unexpected, number 47, also edited by Jack Schiff, which featured the third and final story to cover, The Invasion of the Jewel Men, starring Space Ranger in his 10th appearance. And published around January 21st, Mystery in Space, number 58, edited by Julius Schwartz, featuring the first of 3 stories in a cover, Chariot in the Sky, starring Adam Strange in his 9th comic book appearance. Also that week, the March-April issue of Western Comics number 80, also edited by Julius Schwartz, featuring the first of 2 stories in the cover, The Texas Trail Robbery, starring the Matt Savage Trail Boss in his 4th comic book appearance, and also Powell Smith starred in the issue's 2nd story. And finally that week, World's Finest Comics number 108, edited by Jack Schiff, starring Superman and Batman and the Star Creatures. And this issue also starred Tommy Tomorrow and Green Arrow. Published around January 26th, 1960, the March-April issue of All-American Men of War number 78, edited by Robert Coniger, featuring the first of 3 stories on the cover, Tin Hat for an Iron Man. No, not that Iron Man, who's starred in 2 Marvel movies and next year The Avengers, a different Iron Man. Also that week, the March-April issue of Showcase number 25, edited by Jack Schiff this month, starring Rip Hunter Time Master in his 3rd comic book appearance in the story Captives of the Medieval Sorcerer. And finally, published on or around January 28, 1960, along with Action Comics number 262, Adventure Comics number 270, edited by Mort Weisinger, starring Superboy and the Stolen Identities, which we mentioned earlier. And in this issue, it also starred Congo Bill, making his first Adventure Comics appearance and his 15th overall as Congorilla, as well as Aquaman and Aqualad. Also that week, Detective Comics number 277, edited by Jack Schiff, starring the Batman and Robin story, The Jigsaw Menace from Space, and also starred stories involving Roy Raymond and the Martian Manhunter. And finally, Strange Adventures number 114, edited by Julia Schwartz, and featured the first of three stories on the cover, Secret of the Flying Buzzsaw. And that concludes our look at the comic DC Comics for March-April 1960. Next episode, we'll take a look at the Superman Family comic book, cover dated February 1957, Superman's Pal Jimmy Olsen, number 18, and in 2 weeks, we will take a look at the Superman comic books, cover dated April 1960, Superman, number 136, and Action Comics, number 263.
Boys and girls, your attention, please. Presenting a new exciting radio program featuring the thrilling adventures of an amazing and incredible personality.
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings in a single bound. This amazing stranger from the planet Krypton, the Man of Steel, Superman.
The Thrilling Adventures of Superman. A journey through the golden age of the Man of Steel in comics, radio, and film. Available at greatkrypton.com.
Lancers, I've called you here to this unprecedented gathering because we face an unprecedented danger. An enemy we don't yet fully understand. Moment that we were created, but I don't need to tell you your duty. I don't need to tell you who we are.
Chosen by the mystic guardians of the universe.
Recruited from across the galaxy for their bravery and courage.
The best and brightest join to fulfill a solemn oath.
In brightest day.
In blackest night.
No evil shall escape my sight.
Let those who worship evil's might
beware my power.
Green Lantern's Light.
Green Lantern's Light, a monthly podcast covering the adventures of Hal Jordan, John Stewart, Guy Gardner, and the entire Green Lantern Corps from 1984 through today.
Say the oath. Join the Corps.
Green Lantern's Light. Available monthly at greenlanternslight.com.
You are cordially invited to attend a podcast that observes the unfolding events of history. Come with me and observe the birth and growth of a legend. From the pages of a 10-cent pulp comic book to the newspapers, radio program adventures, theatrical films, and more. Witness the dawn of the superhero. Golden Age Superman. Available on iTunes and at goldenagesuperman.libsyn.com. Every legend has a beginning.
This concludes another episode of the Superman Fan Podcast. The home website can be found at thesupermanfanpodcast.blogspot.com. Episodes are also available on iTunes as well as most other podcast aggregators, as well as supermanfanpodcast.wordpress.com and the Internet Archive at archive.org. Expanded show notes can be found at supermanfanpodcastblog.blogspot.com. Your emails are welcome at supermanfanpodcast@gmail.com, and I look forward to reading them. The Superman Fan Podcast is a proud member of the following: the League of Comic Book Podcasters at comicbooknoise.com/league, the Comics Podcast Network at comicspodcasts.com, the Superman Web Ring of Websites, and the Superman Podcast Network, which can be found at supermanpodcastnetwork.com, home to a variety of podcasts featuring the Man of Steel. The theme music for this podcast is titled Plans in Motion, composed by Kevin MacLeod, part of the royalty-free music library at incompetech.com. If you're interested in the comic books I read each week, you can sample my spoiler-free comic book review blog, my pull list at mypulllist.blogspot.com, and you can send email about this blog to mypulllist@gmail.com. You can join the Superman Fan Podcast and My Pull List groups and pages on Facebook, and follow both the podcast and both blogs on Twitter at Superman Podcast. If you'd like to check out the weekly webcomic I'm working on with From Crisis to Crisis co-host Jeffrey Taylor, go to clockworkcomics.co.uk and try out Slipstream. Clockwork Comics also hosts the webcomic EOS, written and drawn by Adam DeShano, contributor to the Superman homepage website. Superman and all related characters are trademarked and copyright of DC Comics. Any artwork displayed with the show notes is for entertainment purposes only. I make no claim of ownership on the images shown, nor do I earn any money or profit from this podcast. Thanks again for listening to this episode of the Superman Fan Podcast. Join me each week as together we'll crash through the time barrier and fly into the past to explore more Silver Age adventures of Superman, and don't forget to wear your indestructible cape. And, as always, thanks to Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster.